Welcome back to Three Black Dots with Dr. Tiffany, Dr. Karen, and Dr. Zanetta.
Yeah. So then, Karen, to your point, what you were saying about Barack Obama and Kamala Harris, you know, this idea of the first Black president, the first vice presidential nominee on a major party's ticket, and then being immigrants. That's an interesting point that you raise. Because again, I think for both of them, they both talk about how even though they had parents, one who was, in the president's case of African descent, in the vice president nominee's case, Jamaican, that the other parent made sure that they realized that they would be seen as a Black person in America and what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
And so they were raised, their parents knew it, and they were raised that way of like, hey, you are going to be seen as a Black person in America. And I think that with their nominations, I think it matters to see a Black person up there. Did it matter so much to me that it was immigrants and this and that? Mm-mm. They've been treated the same way that, you know, everyone else has. Yeah.
But I think in terms of how they're perceived.
So I was like, I think what you mean is, I think this
I don't know
is
what I mean. I'm tired.
Because you're in a bonnet. So we know you're tired.
Oh,
this is what.
Called you out.
This is what the point is, right? That you can see the difference in the mindset. Yeah. And how do we get that mindset into our kids?
Okay. So now, with the mindset, I think I'm tracking with you now. So Corey and I have this conversation all the time about the class, about our class at Meharry, because it was still, even though I went to Grambling, Meharry was an entirely different experience. You know, some of the people that I was around, I was like, these are just fascinating people. One of the common themes that I found was that, you know, there were families. It didn't matter if you came from a two-parent household or a single-parent household. There was a family in a lot of cases that pushed you to achieve. I think that was almost a common denominator among a lot of us, that there was someone, whether it was a grandma, whether, you know, it was just expected of you, there was just the expectation to achieve. And so I think when you're talking about harnessing that spirit, I hear what you're saying, because I don't think that I saw it until Meharry. Even though I was at Grambling and I got identity at Grambling, you know, was happy with who I was, I saw how just the impact of your background and things that were poured into you, how that can help you. So how do we do that, Karen? Because in my other thing that is surprising to me, it's always fascinating when I hear you speak, because when I think about you, you are the epitome. I would think that you would not have an inferiority complex. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But it took me what, 40 years to change, to understand who I was. And even even still, the fact that I put up, and y'all can't say nothing either, the fact that we put up with the crap that we put up, all I'm saying is that I have colleagues of mine that would never have put up with some stuff we put up with. I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. And when I look at them, those are my African colleagues. Because I look at my folks.
See?
I'm like, wait, you asked for what? You did what? Like, I'm learning so much, but it's a different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you got to remember, Zanetta, you know, my lived experience has been one where I didn't have anyone pouring into. Right? I didn't have that. Not from a family perspective anyway. There was nobody telling me I could achieve. And in fact, it was just the opposite, right? So when I decide I want to go to college and I get zoned from my family, you know what I mean? There's all of that stuff. So yeah, I had a lot of stuff to grow through. And even though I was smart as a whip, and you know, I could have all the people, all the teachers and all the guidance counselors, everybody tell me that, but when your parents aren't proud of you, or when your parents don't tell you that you can make it, there's something about that. And so I think about a lot of our young Black children, particularly those who are descendants of slaves, who may not have people pouring into them because their family structure is such that, you know, they'd have parents, they have two parents who are working all the time. And so, you know, they may not be there to give that feedback to their children, or, you know, they may be a single parent household and mom is struggling, or maybe, you know, dad is in prison because of the way that, you know, structural racism is, you know, whatever that environment is, you know, or their experience is, you know, really wanting to think about what it will take to create environments where our schools are set up around the country, you know, where, and again, this goes, this is a policy issue, really.
Mm-hmm.
It should not, your zip code should not dictate what kind of education you get, nor should it dictate how people pour into you, right? I was fortunate enough, and the reason why I was able to move through and move past the fact that I didn't have familial support is because I had teachers who looked at me and were like, wait, you're not going to college? What? Like, oh, no, we need to fix this. But I also happened to be at one of the better, you know, schools, like that were in the better public schools in my region. So part of my thought process is, you know, is there a way to kind of really replicate the, I like this idea, this concept of pouring into students, right? How do we really replicate what we have seen from those who have been successful, who have had people pouring into them, so that other young students can say, I can achieve whatever I put my mind to, you know?
And my question is it enough to put it in the school, you know, or should we think about the communities at large? I'm thinking that way because with the pandemic, and reading just a lot of articles and when the schools closed, right, about how much the schools are doing in a lot of instances for kids outside of education, you know?
Yes, yes. And it's like, you're right. They're feeding families.
Goodness.
Yes.
Well, there was the food, like how some kids get, you know, the two meals that they can, you know, count on at school. And then the issues of, like, in some instances, school was a safer place for you to be, you know, right, with abuse and these sorts of things. And that was heartbreaking. And, you know, and not something that I gave much thought to until the pandemic kind of shed light on things. And you're like, man, this goes like so deep. And so I think we all kind of think of schools as like the reflex. And I think that's right, of like, well, let's get to the kids in the schools and have programs there, and absolutely for STEM and, like, you know, science pipelines, pre-med pipelines, all of those things. But, you know, when you're talking about how to support kids, I think there are programs that have been started. You know, there's like the Big Brother programs. There was one that my mom used to volunteer with called Each One Teach One, you know, where you were paired with a kid in the community. But again, I think it's gonna take all of us, right, to get involved in different ways.
And I think this goes back to Karen's like lifetime goals with policy, because I mean, there's just so much, because there's like the financial literacy piece, there's the education piece, you know, just trauma and counseling. And I mean, this is, it's so deep, all of these issues. And even this week, something was happening. There were all these kids that were like in the parking lot of my dad's church. And, you know, they're pulling up. They're like, what are you guys doing? And they're using the Wi-Fi.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So they're sitting in the parking lot.
Yes.
Using the Wi-Fi because they have no Wi-Fi.
Yeah, they don't.
And I'm just like, how are you going to do your online learning when you're sitting in the parking lot trying to get some Wi-Fi? Like, this is blowing my mind. And I don't know where to start.
Well, it really does require an entire reboot of the system, right? But
right.
And so Tiffany's got my brain going too, because, you know, you're absolutely right. When I look at it, it goes back to, I don't know if whether it was Zanetta or Tiffany talked about how when there was segregation,
mm-hmm.
there was a community. There was a community surrounding our children and families. And even when I was growing up, to a certain extent, there was some of that was still there, even though I lived in a very mixed neighborhood. my parents knew everybody else's parents. You know, it was like if I said I'm going to so-and-so's house down the street, my parents knew their parents. There was a sense of community. There's less of that nowadays, number one. But this is so deep because it really does go back to the fact that we are not investing in everyone in this country. We're just not. The fact that we have families that are busting their tail and making $7 an hour, you know, that's what we are valuing people's time at, $7 an hour. That's not even a living wage. And so then they have to work multiple jobs and they don't have access to health care. And so you've got children who are literally raising themselves. They don't have parents or, you know, they're hanging out with other kids their age or getting involved in gangs or other things. That's why, you know, we talked about this before. I do feel like gangs have a purpose. And those are some smart folks. I do wish maybe that could be a part of, you know, finding, maybe there can be a way to flip that table where it's not necessarily.
It's not a gang. It's a
community. Positive. That's the community. Yeah. That's the community. Like,
that's where some kids find community, you know.
Yeah. Right. But to be in a positive influence, I know it shouldn't be that way. We need to start by paying people living wages so that they can take care of their families. But that's a challenge. Like even now, people can't work because of COVID and we're still nickeling and diming. Like, just pay people. We're just going to spend more money. Pay people to stay at home for 7 weeks so we can get over this thing, you know?
Right. Karen, it's so hard right now. I mean, I don't know what families are doing. And I just, you know, I feel like the single mom fund, I'm about to donate to it, wherever it is, because I have resources and I feel like I'm struggling.
Yes.
And so I don't know how anyone else is making it. I mean, because now we're talking about thriving. Right? Because we want communities to thrive.
Yes.
I think now during this pandemic, we just want you to come out of this alive. You know?
Yeah, this is survival mode, right?
Right.
But when we get through this, I'm gonna say when. I don't know when how long that's gonna be, but it's a win, you know.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back.
Like what you hear? Make sure you rate and subscribe. Three Black Docs is available wherever you get your podcasts.
I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of just me personally and then like how our society is set up at large. And man, the lifestyle that we're talking about, well, let me take it back. We were saying that before you had communities that knew each other, you know, and all of that. In the times of segregation, but not even then. Like as you were talking about it, I was thinking back to my childhood, and you know, my parents' house, the house I grew up in, is in the burbs, right, of New Orleans. But my parents had a community of people who didn't live in our neighborhood because they wanted to live in the burbs for whatever reason. But there was a community in the city, you know, of my aunt, my mom's sister, my mom's good friend, who that automatically meant that, you know, I was raised with her kids and my friend, you know, automatically from childhood. And so there was still a community, not around where we lived, but
you made your community
around people,
right?
And knowing that you had those people for support, you know. Right. And so my aunt picked me up from school every day, and I was at her house with my cousins after school every day, or I was at, you know, my best friend's house after school, and on the weekends they were over in the burbs swimming in the pool and all of that stuff, you know. So it was like it was. So I don't think that, you know, we talked about it in terms of like when there was segregation and all of that. I think we can do that. You can build your community. It doesn't even have to be geographic.
Yes.
And you have to have the time and the will
right
to want to
to want to do that,
right?
Yeah,
but again, it goes back to the economics. It's hard to have the time when you're working multiple jobs.
That's right.
And to that point, I feel like one of the huge disservices of this, of the way that our current system is set up, in addition to not paying people living wages, people are, have more incentive sometimes to not work or to live on their own. So there was an 18-year-old when I was in Boston who's like, all right, well, I'm about to, you know, I'm just going to wait because when I turn 18, I'm going to declare myself independent so I can get on Section 8 or whatever it is. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, she had it all planned out so that she could move away from her mom. And I'm like, you know, what happened to family units? And a lot of that is because there's not that cohesiveness because the family unit has been so torn apart in many ways. But, you know, we also incentivize people to not live at home with their parents or their extended family so that you can build that community. Because, you know, if you live with somebody else, you might not get the same amount of support from the welfare system or whatever. You know, and I know when I was on welfare, you guys know I was on welfare for a short time.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to go to school and that was a problem for the welfare system, you know, that they disincentifize that. They
what do you mean?
Disincentifize. Oh, it, you could. I was, you know, they you're only allowed to, number one, have so many resources. So, you know, if I were to live in the dorms, that would have been considered a resource. If I owned a car, that's considered a resource. So, but if I have a car, I need to get from my, you know, to work, then that's, you still have a resource. They don't really incentivize you to work. At least they didn't back when I was on welfare. I was working in the summertime and I would work at the law firm that I had been working at before I went to college. And, you know, I would make a couple of grand in the summertime and they were like, yeah, you made too much money. You got to give it, you got to pay us back. And I'm like, wow. You know, like there's, it really does incentivize you to not do anything, right? Versus, you know, kind of allowing people to work through the system. The welfare system should be a stepping stone. It should not be something that people are on permanently. And to that point, there are families who literally are worried about getting raises. You know, they call it the Medicaid cliff. There are families who are working very hard workers, working full-time jobs, sometimes more than one job, but they're not paid enough because we're not paying people living wages. And so, you know, they may be working these couple of jobs and so they're on Medicaid. And that pays for their insurance coverage, you know, for their family. They're offered promotions that would pay them more money, but they decline because the money that they would make with that promotion would actually cause them to no longer be eligible for Medicaid. And then when they're no longer eligible for Medicaid, then they have to buy their own health insurance. And by having to pay their own health insurance and all the deductibles and everything like that, they would actually be in a worse deficit.
Right.
But it's an example of one of the types of programs, whereas instead of saying, okay, this person, we want to support people as they transition through. We want to support people as they make their way through, you know, and start to build their family capacity. And so, yes, you can, you get your promotion and you stay on and get your health care, you know, and you have that for a year, 2 years or whatever, or expand what it means to be on Medicaid. And that's why I feel like there are so many issues that are surrounding just finances. A lot of the problems are related to finances and financial well-being. And that's a huge problem for the Black community because, again, particularly those who are descendants of slaves, have not had the opportunity to build wealth in the same way that other communities have. Have we solved it? Have we fixed it?
We have identified the problems.
I don't. No. What kind of cereal is that? Fruit Loops?
It's Fruity Lucky Charms.
Ugh.
You know, it's funny. It doesn't sound
right.
Does
not sound appetizing.
But when you eat it, it reminds you of your childhood.
No. Because they didn't have Fruity Lucky Charms. They just had the beige ones.
It reminds you of something. It reminds you of something when you see.
Well, the marshmallows were colored, though. The marshmallows.
Yeah, the marshmallows, but not. But
yeah,
the wheat part was beige.
The wheat part.
No, I agree. I said the same thing because Corey was like, this is my joint. And I was like, nobody's going to eat that. Then I tasted it. It did something.
That is so funny.
It's 10 o'clock at night.
And?
You eat Lucky Charms at 10 o'clock at night?
It's beautiful. Beautiful thing. Cereal is made for the nighttime. It is made.
Oh, God.
For the nighttime.
It's lactose-free milk if it makes you feel better.
It does not. But thanks. It actually makes my stomach feel better, but anyhow.
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know. So mindset. So it's first we got to solve the financial issues.
Well, but this
people need time to live life, which includes giving back to communities and being there for other people. And three, mindset.
And all three of them need to be done simultaneously.
Right. So, and like right now.
To your guys' point, we can't wait. We can't wait for the politicians, right?
Thank you.
I know.
Thank you.
Whatever. So that'll be interesting, though. I think that'll be a very interesting premise to start thinking about. How to start building that capacity in communities, despite all of the challenges, and what are some ways to do that? How do we kind of work with the current circumstances to really create environments that will be fertile soil to start growing some of these young minds, fertile soil for really being able to help to grow individuals and families? It doesn't matter if they're young or old. I mean, there are people who are hungry to have support, right? They're hungry to have community around them. It doesn't matter how old they are. And they could be missing some of that. And, you know, what are some ways that we can do that in a sustainable way, right? In a sustainable way, you know, without it getting torn down. We've had that, right? We had that in Oklahoma. We had that in Durham. You know, we had the Black Wall Street.
Right.
We had those communities even beyond, you know, kind of.
Right.
So how do we get back to that and really kind of make sure that it's sustainable and, you know, and that it's not just in one or two locations, that it's really universal where communities like that can be formed. That's really important. I like this conversation.
I mean, I'm encouraged because I'm already seeing community starting to say, you know, we're going to do our own thing, like with the Fertile Ground Co-op.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I love that concept of like, hey, we're food desert. We're going to start our own co-op, you know, and get healthy options here. I was reading today about efforts to do neighborhood composts. That's a separate issue. But
yeah, I don't want to talk. Look, she's going to get into plants and
it always comes back to plants.
We're not talking about plants today.
Always,
we are not talking about plants today.
Plants. Back to plants.
There are neighborhoods who are organizing neighborhood composts. I'm just saying. But also, there are neighborhoods who are organizing neighborhood gardens. Right?
Yes.
Teaching kids how to garden and, you know, providing produce for the community. Yeah. So, you know, I love reading about stuff like that. Just have to figure out how to get more involved in it. That's it. But to me, the most interesting thing about this, you know, sitting with the physician's hat and the kind of the realization that I came to, and you guys know this, is like, I think there's just so much to be done that's outside of the hospital. And this is what we talk about, right? 20% of health is medicine, and the rest is what goes on outside of the hospital.
So what kind of system do we need? We need a public health system, right, Tiff?
Yes.
What Michelle was saying. Michelle Obama heard you say.
Yes.
We need a better public health system.
That's right. With community gardens and neighborhood compost piles where everyone can come and get their compost for their gardens.
She had to put dang planting.
Fruit trees to feed everyone.
Whatever.
Always.
I want to be a gardener for you.
There's a plant. And a cicadan exoskeleton.
That's just nasty.
That's just, I was like, who keeps exoskeletons?
It's good for the kids.
Is it?
Yeah. To learn. It's science. It's science. It's nature.
She's so excited about it too.
Free Black Docs is not intended as medical advice. All opinions are our own. Free Black Docs is produced by Wings Productions.
Like what you hear? Make sure you rate and subscribe. Three Black Docs is available wherever you get your podcasts.